Welcome, everyone, to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley from Single Sourcing Solutions. I'm your moderator. This is Jana Summers from TC Camp. She's our interviewer. And welcome to Dr. Nancy Small and Dr. Bernadette Longo, today's guests in Room 42. Nancy Small is an assistant professor of English and the director of the first year writing at the University of Wyoming. She joined UW as a tenure track faculty in 2016 after 25 years teaching faculty at Texas A&M, the last six of which were spent at the branch campus in Qatar. Her monograph, A Rhetoric of Becoming, U.S. American Women in Qatar, is based on ethnographic research of the white expatriate community during the 6 years living and working in the Middle East. It will be out midsummer next year. She received the Spring 2021 Fellowship with the Wyoming Institute of Humanities Research. Her work has been published in journals such as PAETHO, the Journal of Coalition of Feminist Scholars in the History of Rhetoric and Composition, the Journal of Technical Writing and Communication, the Journal of Usability Studies, as well as many scholarly books about transnational and intercultural issues. Her current projects include an article on reading handmade material artifacts as textual memoirs of their erased makers, and a book-length project on rhetoric, placemaking, and public memory in the U.S. American West. Bernadette Longo is an associate professor of the Department of Humanities at New Jersey Institute for Technology. She's the author of A Spurious Coin, A History of Science, Management, and Technical Writing from SUNY in 2000, Edmund Berkeley and the Social Responsibility of Computing Professionals, ACM Press in 2015, Words and Power, Computers, Language, and the U.S. Cold War Values, coming in 2021, very soon now, because we're almost through. She's the co-editor of Critical Power Tools, Technical Communication, and Critical Studies in SUNY Press 2006, and the IEEE Guide to Writing in the Engineering and Technical Fields from IEEE Press in 2017. She's written and presented numerous journal articles and conference papers and enjoys living life by a small lake in New Jersey. They've co-authored a new book, Transnational Research in Technical Communication, Realities and Reflections, a collection of stories from the trenches. And it just became available within this last month. Today, they're here to talk about their book and help us start answering the question, what strategies can we use to navigate the challenges of design, management, analysis, and delivery of projects that cross national borders? Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning.
We are so excited to have you here today. And thank you so much for both of you joining us to talk about your book. Now, it's coming out next year.
Yeah. It looks like
middle
July.
Of the year.
Yeah.
July of 22.
Right. So I'm going to put it on my calendar because I'm going to want one. I got a little taste of it just to, you know, truth be told, I got a little taste and it's quite interesting. So what got you involved? I like origins. So let's talk about what started this book.
The book?
Yes. Let's talk about what started the book.
Nancy asked me to work with her on it. So I'm going to.
Nancy's the instigator.
Yes, she is. And it is. And I was so happy to receive that invitation to have that initial conversation because Nancy's invitation really hit on some of the trouble spots that I had with my work in the DR Congo. So I'm going to let Nancy take it away. What did you ask me, Nancy?
I said, Bernadette, I'm frustrated. Can we make a book together? And you can be my mentor as a senior scholar, and I can be the workhorse as the junior scholar, because I also want the experience of putting together an edited collection. And I just want to really briefly, because it would be the totally wrong thing to do not to say this, but one of our authors, Nabila Hijazi, is one of the attendees, along with Sarah Hillman, who I worked with in Qatar, Charity Tran, who is my dear friend and colleague from Texas Tech, and Angie Bates, who is a sister of mine. So I just, because they're here, I got to give them a little shout out and give them my love, all four of them, and thank them. So where this came from for me was twofold. One was when I spent these 6 years in Qatar. First, I wanted my dissertation to be about Qatari women. This is my naive dissertation idea, which I look back with chagrin, but still have to own it because it's where I was then.
And you grew from it, so it's okay.
Exactly, right?
Because we're all on an evolutionary path.
We know better, do better, right?
Yes.
So my first couple of years there, I did my PhD work. I started my PhD at 40, so after a long career of teaching. And so I was very excited by these new ideas. And I was, of course, excited by where I was living, because it was transformative. It was an amazing space to be in. Mm-hmm. And I felt like a very valued guest. And so I wanted to learn more. So at first I thought I would look at our engineering branch campus had about 50% women, which is incredible for an engineering program. U.S. engineering programs can't maintain that kind of gender balance. And so I wanted to learn more about those women's motivations, their successes, their struggles, where they went on to. Wow. Then after some study and reflection and conversation, of course, I came to realize that that was going to be a little bit of a problematic study for me to do on my own, maybe with a collective of other Qatari and Arabic women who could be more of the insiders and make sure I wasn't doing harm with my study. So I left that behind. But in that ensuing time, I ended up studying women like me, white US American expats. But in that time, I started looking for advice on better practices for transnational and intercultural research. I wanted to know how to do this, at least some guidance on questions I could ask myself so that I would do less harm than is likely possible for traditional Western research, which is such a colonial endeavor. So I went looking for ideas. And so I went looking, therefore, for reflections and kind of lessons learned, and it was really hard to find them. Bernadette's article about her experience with the Congo, which I call Longo in the Congo because that's the way I remember it. So I'm sorry, Bernadette, but that's the title in my head is Longo in the Congo.
Now we'll never forget. We'll go Google Longo in the Congo.
It was one of the few places, literally a handful, just three or four articles I could find in TechCom that actually provided some serious reflection to help me think about my own positionality and my own relational accountability to the spaces I was in.
Right.
So I went about drafting what now is the conclusion of the book, most of the conclusion, and I sent it to one journal and they responded within 24 hours, which is great. And they said, no, thank you. We don't do theory. So I sent it to another journal and it took them 3 months to respond. And they said, no, thank you. You don't have a methods section, which is so typical for TechCom scholarly production, because if it's not a social science based research method, it's like they kind of don't know what to do with it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So then I applied it towards a book and they accepted it. But then they said, we want you to do a mini comprehensive lit review. I don't know what a mini, M-I-N-I, mini comprehensive lit review is, because that seems like an oxymoron to me.
It is, isn't it?
So I ended up writing a 9,000, I turned in, like a 2,000 word lit review, and they came back and they said, this is great, we want more. So it turned into a 9,000 word lit review, over 600 sources published in 5 years, at which point they said, we'll just cut this off here. And they cut it off at the very beginning of what is the conclusion of this book. In other words, they didn't want the work that I had offered them. Mm-hmm. And so so they wanted more of a meta study, which is what they got. So that's when I literally the day that I got that email saying, we'll just cut it off here, is the same day I emailed Bernadette. And I said, hey, now I just want to relate this really quickly and then I'll stop. I attended a webinar yesterday by Anna Ribeiro and Sonia Arellano, and they're talking about Latina feminist mentoring practices. Mm-hmm. And one of their practices is fuerza, or strength. And what they say is you have to take the energy required to persist and the frustrations and disappointments that you face as a scholar and as someone who then mentors scholars who are also facing those. And you have to leverage those into the energy to actually be a driving force in your production. Mm-hmm. And I think Bernadette and I have shared some of that fuerza. And she was my mentor a little bit in giving me permission to take what I had done and turn it into something else. Also a shout out to my colleague, Tracy mm-hmm. Patton, who's in comm studies, and she has had to also experience these things. So mm-hmm. it's actually a very interesting origin story with a long history.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, usually when you're breaking new ground and you're shifting a dynamic, it's not always an easy thing, but the cause is very worthwhile. I find it perplexing. I understand what you're saying, but I do find it perplexing, you know, I'm sure everyone here does, that for something that's so human-centered in technical and professional communications is all about the humans we're communicating to, that they aren't interested in the stories behind the scene. And so much is left on the floor.
I think, though, when you're dealing with academic versions mm-hmm. of technical communication, mm-hmm. that humanistic approach to what we're doing is not valued very much, just to be blunt, because, well, the article that Nancy refers to that I finally did get published about my work in
Longo in the Congo.
Yeah. Right. The editor of the journal said, okay, you have to put it in the IMRAD format, you know? Mm-hmm. And because it had started out, actually, this started out with some people in the Society for the Social Studies of Science, the 4S, saying, oh, we love this work and we want to have you related in a narrative manner and storytelling. We're really behind this. Some people and we did some work together, these two guys and I. And but when I submitted it to the journal, they were, you know, oh my God, you know, we don't want this kind of thing. You don't have enough methods. You don't have enough structure. You know, this is a story. What do we do with it? They absolutely were putting a boundary around their turf mm-hmm. and they didn't want me in it, you know, and they certainly didn't want somebody's story who wasn't a sociologist
right.
In their journal. Huh. So finally, you know, and this is a, you know, I have been lambasted by sociologists. I've been lambasted by African studies people. I've been lambasted by technical communication people who want this in the IMRAD format. I've been told in many ways that I'm a do-gooder. I'm a white woman. I'm, you know, I have no standing ever with this project, you know, which was a failed project, by the way, too, for political reasons. And yet it abides, you know, it won't leave. So I finally wrote it up in the IMRAD format and squished this human experience into, and again, left a lot on the floor.
Really quick for others who might not know, could you just spell out IMRAD for them so that they know? Because I know we rush right through it and I'm like, I know what you're talking about.
Well, that's a scientific report writing format that mm-hmm. has an introduction, a methods section, a results section, and a discussion section,
right.
Which is the model for stereotypical scientific
studies. All scientific journals, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and this was not that. But I forced this human experience into a scientific, you know, reporting structure, right. and left all the humanity of it on the floor.
Because the IMRAD is very scrubbed. It's like the rigor of it, and I want to get to that whole topic of rigor that Nancy, I think you brought up in the book too. But the discipline of it is very sterilized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And everybody's successful.
Yeah, right.
You know, else you don't report it.
Right.
If you're not successful, you don't report it.
That's another big, huge problem with that is because
you learn from failure too.
Yes. Sometimes you learn more from failures than you do from success.
And as teachers, I know that my students, if we're all in the comfort zone, not trying things and making mistakes, we are not learning.
No, we're comfy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Right. So when Nancy, said, hey, do you want to, explore this from a humanistic point of view, which I had in the meantime, my way to use my rage was to start writing articles on humanism as having a methodological foundation that we could articulate, just like the scientific method is well articulated. However, humanistic approaches to research are not well articulated, probably because they go back so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. We just assume we know what it is or what it is not. So anyway, when Nancy asked me would I like to work with her on this collection, I was both thrilled and said, oh my God, not again. Do I have to revisit this horrible experience again? But I think it's finally, Nancy and I have made something really positive and good out of what was just a lingering problem in my case.
And shout out to Miles Kimball and Charles Sides at SUNY, because I knew this was meant to be, because first Bernadette responded well within 24 hours. It might have been within an hour. Like, I just sent her a two sentence pitch and she said, yes, let's talk.
Right.
And then when we sent our, short email pitch to Charles and Miles, I think we heard back within a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. Yes, we would like a proposal. Mm-hmm. And so then the editors at SUNY, James and Tim, have also been incredibly responsive. And so I think we're not as alone as we feel like we are, Bernadette. Mm-hmm. Also, there's been people like Natasha Jones and Rebecca Walton, who's also, Rebecca's in our collection, but also Kristen Moore. They've been trying to push storytelling as kind of part of the social justice turn in TPC.
Yeah.
So we aren't alone. We just need kind of a gravitational force to kind of actually wedge ourselves in there. And I feel like this book will be part of that force, a contribution to it.
Mm-hmm. And actually, Dale Sullivan, back in the 90s, probably tried to do this as well and got, I'm forgetting the name of the book, but it was a collection of stories about practitioners and connecting it with theoretical understandings of technical communication. However, the book was not well received at that time, but I do believe that the times have changed enough, and it's I am very optimistic for the how this upcoming collection is going to be received.
Just want to say, Bernie, that I think you're talking about, it's called Writing a Professional Life. And it's Jerry Savage and Dale Sullivan. And then also in 2013, Gerald Savage and Han Yu published Negotiating Cultural Encounters. And those are the kind of the models for this book. It's why it has, each chapter has a story. And then it has some suggested readings with an annotated bib. And then it has discussion questions. So it's modeled on previous collections. But I think the time is just a little riper for us, maybe.
And I do want to give a shout out to those guys who went before us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because each person who's chipped away at this is creating, it's lifting up and elevating it for the next people that come along. And as long as we continue to push and have conversations and continue to author books like this, then eventually that's how it gets into the mainstream, right? Is people who are blazing those trails. And I think it's interesting that, because we were talking earlier about how sometimes things seems like a lot of work, right? A lot of your soul goes into it and your angst, like you get fired up and that gets poured into it and channeled into it. And those come from trials and tribulations. But the nice thing in this is that the universe lined up and everyone, they get you, right? Mm-hmm. So that kind of creates that path to say, okay, now is the time is right. Mm-hmm. I find it interesting that stories got omitted and now we have to fight to get them back in, because stories have been around since the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. Before we started writing things down, we orated them. And they were important for learning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's really the master narrative of the positivistic, like that kind of empirical research, right? Here's how to do it right, which silences. I mean, we hear now, and I love that there's a resurgence. I mean, they've always been there. They're still alive, but the Indigenous American community is like reasserting, like there's more space like for them to reassert themselves. Mm-hmm. And they have a story-based epistemology, a story-based way of understanding the world and making knowledge. Like Robin Wall Kimmerer works at this intersection of Western botany and Indigenous mm-hmm. storytelling. And it's important, valid, rigorous work. But, you know, I hate to throw around big academic terms because it annoyed me before when I didn't understand them. But like this whole idea of hegemony, right? One narrative squishing out everything mm-hmm. else. And mm-hmm. so we have to fight from the margins to get these narratives back. And I think of the Indigenous storytellers as like our Aristotles. Aristotle mm-hmm. mentions narrative a little, but not very much. It's really storytelling as a craft, as a rhetorical craft, has been developed over these millennia. Mm-hmm. It just, the West's version of science being the only way to know tends to erase it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right, like forcing things into a methodology and leaving all of the stories and the trials and tribulations on the floor or hidden, right? And thereby you stunt the impact of what that research was, right? The true impact. Because all of these foibles that happened along the way, all these failures that happened along the way, first off, you know, people shouldn't be ashamed to talk about failures, right? And I think that's one of the problems with the MRAD is, you know, people are kind of, you know, they don't want to talk about failures because that makes that they think that makes them look bad, mm-hmm. right? But in stories, we relate to those failures. We relate when people fail at something.
Well, you know, as somebody who's had to talk about her failure with this project for years now, talking about a failure makes the person who failed vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yeah.
When we have this highly competitive, milieu that we're working in, whether it's business or whether it's academia, which academia is super highly competitive and cutthroat, as yes. is business. And as a woman, when I'm talking about my failures, I am admitting, I'm putting myself in such a weak position that it's only now that, I have an established mm-hmm. career. I've got nothing to prove. I'm not trying to, I'm trying to retire, quite frankly, but I'm on that end of my career.
Yes. Yes.
And so for me to talk about my failures is less, makes me less vulnerable because I have less to lose. But for people who are earlier in their career, people who are untenured, people who are trying to, in an academic setting or are starting their career in business, and are women, I just have to say, who wants to put themselves in that weak of a position? But I think that by bringing the knowledge making, by valuing the knowledge making of storytelling,
right,
and the truths that can be communicated and found through storytelling, and which is an interactive, it's a necessarily interactive activity of, you know, as storyteller and the people who are listening, making mm-hmm. some knowledge and truth amongst themselves, I think is if we can value that and understand there are more ways to know the world and to operate in the world than science, hopefully we will find, you know, have more safer spaces to talk about what went wrong or what we feel went wrong, which may not have actually even gone wrong, you know, and mm-hmm. There's always some thing to learn.
I think Bernadette touches on something really important. One of the kind of tangible reasons why storytelling gets degraded in our knowledge-making processes, right, is that stories don't necessarily tell you how to think. Mm-hmm. All stories right. don't have some clear moral or outcome, like do this or don't do that. Mm-hmm. So storytelling and story receiving are interactional and relational processes. Not mm-hmm. it's the relation between the teller and the receiver, but it's also the relation of the story to the life world of the people that are mm-hmm. telling and receiving. So even if Bernadette tells me a story, she and I may have a relational understanding of what that might mean. But mm-hmm. also if she then reflects it back on her own life world, she's going to see it in a different lens than if I take it and I think about it in terms of my life world. And right. so I think that when people want to read an article, get an outcome, apply the outcome and move on down the road, storytelling is frustrating because it requires mm-hmm. patience. It requires mm-hmm. reflecting over relationality. Sometimes mm-hmm. it requires re-examining your own positioning. Mm-hmm. So storytelling requires more of the receiver, I think, than mm-hmm. traditional scientific or social science style writing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Because you can just, you know, read the top part and get down to the bottom and skip the whole middle. Mm-hmm. But
and there's a place for that.
Right. There is. Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, there's got to be a way to get that story because, you know, if I'm interested in the top and the bottom, then what I might want to see that middle, and that story mm-hmm. is more important than just, you know, the sanitized research method that you, you know, then go into great detail on, but leave the story out. So mm-hmm. how would you integrate that in? Is it possible to change that style, to integrate stories?
Good question.
It's got me going down another way too, right? So if you know, the MRAD is all about reproduction, mm-hmm. right? And you're talking about stories, mm-hmm. two different researchers may not get the same story from the same subject person, mm-hmm. certainly won't get the same story from two people who are not the same person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where that goes or what the implications are, but it certainly changes what you, maybe there's something there all by itself, because that's interesting to me too. I don't know. I've got all kinds of crazy ideas happening and they're not formed yet.
Well, but I mean, you bring up a really good point because stories are not easily replicated. You cannot, because you're influenced by your own personal biases. When you're reading a story or listening to a story, you have your life experience that you pull into it, right?
Right, your context, your time, where you are at that point in time when you hear the story, right? You can hear the story again 10 years later and you get different lessons.
Right.
Even if you're talking to the same person and they won't tell you, like if you're talking to a real person, they may change their story based on who they're talking to.
Mm-hmm. And yet to me, the story is really important because then I can get a deeper understanding. For me, hearing a story allows me to have a deeper understanding of the methods and the research work.
Mm-hmm. It really gets to questions, I think, of what we value and count, mm-hmm. especially in the West,
yes.
as knowledge. And I don't mean, mm-hmm. I know I'm reinforcing, but I really don't want to reinforce the binary of positivism versus like storytelling or narrative. I think there's a place for all of it. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking in terms of, so what does replicability really push us to desire? it pushes us to desire some almost quantifiable process that we can identify as an outcome so that we can predict human behavior, mm-hmm. right? AI would be a great example of human type behavior, but that is replicable because there's algorithms that drive it that can be amended, right? Mm-hmm. But so then I think also in terms like there's RAD, I think that's Haswell, right? I want to give credit where credit's due. The replicable, aggregable, and data-driven research is what we're looking mm-hmm. for in TechCom and mm-hmm. in writing studies in general. So I turn to aggregability because I think about aggregability, I think of it kind of like Legos, even though that's pretty simplistic, but like things build on each other. Right. So maybe Sarah, who's in Qatar still, she does a study of expatriate women that are working there from the West. Her study is not going to replicate mine, even if she asks them the same questions. Mm-hmm. So there's like that technical replication. She could ask them the same questions, mm-hmm. but the stories they share are going to be different. The way she interprets them is going to be different. The way I go back and look at the stories, like Liz was saying, now 8 years, 10 years later is going to be different. But what you have there is a conversation. You have different storytellers joining in the same circle. So I think the aggregability is really strong as long as what we value is multiple perspectives rather than a kind of AI algorithmically driven knowledge. So it really, I think it gets to what do we value? And it's okay to have some of both. So I'm not, again, I'm not trying to make it one or the other.
Mm-hmm. But you know, scientific replicability is more of an idea than it is a reality anyway.
Sure.
Because mm-hmm. even if you take a scientific research report, generally there's not enough information in that report by the time it gets distributed to actually replicate the study. And how many times, I mean, it gets studies get replicated sometimes, I imagine, but by and large, scientific studies are not done again in the same way to verify the results. So that's kind of a, that's an interesting value statement in a way. Yeah. That we should be able to take people out of the process and get the same, you know, results in a very positivist world.
And I don't know how you take people out of the process for communication studies. Like, really?
That's the whole thing. That's the whole thing is because, like you said, Nancy, somebody can ask a question. I could ask the same question and we're going to get different answers, even if we ask the same person, especially if we ask the same person on different days and different circumstances, because our life influences how we answer questions, right? So there's that whole, the human side of it, you're never going to get exact replicas. That's kind of the beauty of it. And that's why we need to see different perspectives and different experiences, right?
And a question would be, why do we want things to be replicable anyway? Why is that a value?
I can take a guess at why some might want things easily replicated. It's comfortable, predictable.
It gives you the illusion that it is uncontaminated when everything is contaminated.
And it's controllable.
Yes, we love that illusion of control over life.
Right.
That's why failure, displacement, right? It's unnerving, but it's also the most educational.
Because it's unnerving.
Well, it gets us out of our comfort zone. You know, if we know everything and we're comfortable and, you know, there's nothing to challenge the way we're doing things or thinking or anything. Again, we're not learning. We may be comfortable in everything, but I wouldn't say that we're learning anything.
Right. Because the whole goal really is to push things forward and to lift up, you know, those coming up behind us.
And it, just like in any good story, the story progresses through conflict. You know, if everything's going swell, you don't have you don't really have much of a story. I mean, you've got a little tiny story, but if everything's just fine, the story doesn't progress. So right. Even in a narrative model, you need that tension and what, you know, in literary studies is conflict. I'm, you know, right. Maybe that's not a great word either, but you need the
tension.
Dramatic tension.
Yeah,
there you go.
But it's but that's important too, because the resolution of that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's a great book. Oh boy. I don't have his name in my head, but it's about the ways that stories function in different areas of education. And he talks about, even in science, what you have is the setup and the tension of the research problem.
Yeah.
And then the resolution when the results come out of the lab. So even writing about science in that MRAD format is a kind of story.
Yeah.
It's just one we've been cultured to trust more than we trust when our dad or Aunt Betty or our neighbor across the hall in our building tells us a story.
Yeah.
I got a weird question just because it occurs to me. So if we're telling the stories, right? And literary scholars, what they do is they look at stories, right? They're doing analysis on stories. Are we producing things for them to then do their part on the stories that we tell? Like, does this feed that part of it? And is that the advancement, right? Are we advancing things in a different, like through a different path that we might not expect? I don't know.
You mean a kind of a convergence among the arts and the social sciences? Is that like?
No, I was thinking just straight up, so literary scholar, like, I'm doing an analysis of whatever theme in Jane Austen. They could do a whatever analysis of some theme in your collection of stories.
Oh, yeah.
So we are actually kind of producing first level material that then goes through a second level of analysis.
You know, when I was in my PhD work, that's exactly, my goal was to take literary theory and apply it to mundane texts, and Foucault's words are technical texts. So yeah, I would say yes, cool. There's a very fruitful area of cultural studies of technical documents, or applying literary theory to the stories in our collection, which are about, technical projects, technical writing or communication projects. So I think that there's, my whole research agenda has been to see how speculative I could be in non-scientific and still work in technical communication.
Love that. Neat. Just to follow up on what Bernadette's pointing out, is that story and narrative can function in all different kinds of ways in research. So there is narrative analysis, which is what you're talking about. A lot of times that's like thematic analysis of data. So if you interview 12 customers, you can do a thematic analysis of what they tell you, right? So you can apply literary style analysis to data. There's also narrative representation, which is what we have in this book. Mm-hmm. It's taking research and presenting it through a narrative form. There's also narrative inquiry, which I'm teaching a class about this semester. It comes out of education, a scholar named Jean Clendenin. And what you're actually doing there is you're sitting with your interview, and instead of having a direct research question and highly formulated interview questions, you have a research puzzle. So something that you're pondering, and you sit with your interview and have conversations while you also do your own free writes and your own reflection. Mm-hmm. And then you create a narrative account that you take back to your interviewee and you read it with them. And so it's not as sterilizing as I will take your responses, I will code them, I will then produce knowledge. So it's much more like Chris Ratcliffe's rhetorical listening. It's a laying alongside. And so there's a whole narrative inquiry method that's not in this book. This book is really about a representation of research through narrative and the things that I love how Jana says have been left on the cutting room floor, the lessons we can
learn. Well, and you need the representation in order to expand the rest of everything else. I mean, like, that's been part of the problem. They're all on the cutting room floor. They haven't been as publicized, as included, as, you know, visible in a way that we can, that the rest of, you know, the West of Western scholarship has focused. Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's all left on the floor. So you need that in order to advance all of it.
And yet, you know, in usability studies and marketing research and things like that, where we're doing scenarios and personas and things like that, that is an effort to reintroduce storytelling in order to understand what we're doing more fully. You know, so I think we can see really how this might be even applicable in a practical sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because all of this in the technical writing community, where you would think that they'd want to be more sterile, there's such a hunger for bringing the human. And we all talk about, you know, the customer is the focus point, you know, the customer matters. So we do all these things to try and re-engage with the humanity of it, with the humans, right?
But which I think attests to the strength of the scientific model or the hegemony, as Nancy is, you know, the imposition of that on so many aspects of our lives.
Right.
Pushing back.
The story stuff is the warp on which our entire lives are woven. It's all in there. Yes. It's just we like to deny it or erase it or mute it. As the conversation began with the MRAD format, it's like we want that we identify that as the cream that rises to the top is the process and the outcomes, but that the curd of the whole thing is storytelling. It's story based because we all narrate our lives when we ask questions like, what's going on here? Or what's the problem? Or how do people experience this? Those are all storied kind of questions. We just like to, in the making of knowledge, whatever that really means, we just like to move away from it.
Right.
And I wonder how many people have written research work and have felt that their stories don't matter. And in fact, they really do. Right?
But wasn't it Jenny Reddish doing government research back in the 80s or something? Who, what was it, loan documents or something like that she was looking at? And she doing speak aloud the protocols with people. And as they read these documents, they were telling themselves stories about how they fit into what these steps, how they would do it, where they were in these steps. So even with highly technical documents that are made for getting a task done, how we're reading these things is telling ourselves stories about, okay, now I do this, and this is what I have to do here. And we're always inserting this narrative view of the world, even into highly technical documents as readers.
And you bring up a really good point.
The world.
Yeah, and you bring up a really good point. If I'm an aircraft mechanic, right, and I'm reading this manual on how to repair this aircraft, I'm putting myself in those steps that you're writing.
That's right.
Because as a human, I think we all do this. We try to involve all of our senses into the experience of it because that's how we integrate lessons, right? And when I'm being informed or instructed, I want to adapt those instructions and adopt them, integrate them so that I can execute efficiently, mm-hmm. right? That's the whole point of it. So that's why the story is really important, because the human's reading this. Mm-hmm. When we're informing and instructing humans, that story, I think, is critical.
Mm-hmm. I know we're so close to time, but mm-hmm. I want to sort of, and I'm going to say it the way I'm going to say it anyway. Do you think this comes out of, like, this has been your focus, Burnett, kind of the whole time, mm-hmm. right? And Nancy, you've gravitated to this and to Bernadette, and it's part of the way that you all are processing the world, and that the other people who are trained in the typical way don't process. So I'm like super grateful that you guys could come here and share that this way of processing the world with us, because we're happy. I think some of us do that.
Well, I think I speak for Nancy when I say we're happy you asked us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I really do think that there's more and more of a growing interest for people, and a growing trend and a hunger for the stories and all the stuff that got left out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And that, you know, just talking about the words that we use and how we use them and how we frame things. Mm-hmm. And I think that that sensitivity is growing. And it's becoming the focal point for a lot of people, even in the most techiest of technical writing.
Mm-hmm. I hope so.
Me too.
That's our mission.
Liz is squinting. Well, we'll keep pushing that forward, right? That's mm-hmm. And it's interesting, because that's how you start to change the shape of things and allow mm-hmm. outlets. It'd be really mm-hmm. interesting to see other researchers who are doing research work have a little side journal and write their experiences, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. one of the good practices in research to have a research journal where you actually bring yourself into that journal, but then you're supposed to close the lid and leave yourself in that journal. And we hope that there's more space mm-hmm. to acknowledge that that's not an authentic or fully realized way to understand the knowledge making that we do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely.
This has been very interesting conversation.
We're way past time. Like, we couldn't stop.
Yeah, we've gone way past time. We forgot to even keep track of time.
And we could just keep going.
I know. I certainly have appreciated this conversation. I cannot wait for the book. All right, everybody. Thank you again. Thanks everybody for being here. And I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks to our attendees.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.